Welcome to the final round of the 1969 National Debate Tournament. For the last 3 days, we have been debating here at Northern Illinois University, reducing the field of 44 regional winners to the two teams that you see seated here before you. The two teams that will compete in this final round for the national championship. On the affirmative, Harvard University, first affirmative Richard Lewis, and second affirmative Joel Perwin. For the negative, University of Houston, first negative Mike Miller, and second negative David Seichel. We will have seven judges for this round. The seven judges' ballots will determine the national championship. Our judges are Dan Rohr from Oberlin, John Boaz from Illinois State, Jim Chesborough from Concordia College, Jim Unger from Georgetown, John Lehman from Kansas State at Emporia, and Herb James from Dartmouth. Without further interruption then, except for a brief break between the constructive speeches and rebuttals, here is the final round for the national championship in debate in 1969. Good luck to both teams.
The seventh judge, omitted by an error, is Mr. Jackson of Michigan State University. Frankly, I want my mother. All the people who lined the streets began to cry, "Just look at the emperor's new clothes, how beautiful they are." Then suddenly a little child piped up, "But the emperor has no clothes on. He has no clothes on at all." In 1947, the United States created the Central Intelligence Agency and donned the cloak of secrecy to pursue communism. Experience has proven the cloak we donned was nothing more than the emperor's new clothes, hiding far less than we have long pretended and exposing America to peril. Because Joel and I believe it is time we all recognize the American emperor's mistake, we stand resolved that executive control of United States foreign policy be significantly curtailed. We believe the executive should be prohibited from carrying out covert operations, that is, attempts to tamper with the structure of any country or institution in the conduct of foreign policy while concealing our involvement. Our first contention, discovery of covert operations undermines American objectives. Discovery of covert operations undermines American objectives. There are three dimensions to the harm. First, discovery strengthens communism. It strengthens communism. When America is discovered attempting to dictate a nation's political future, that nation resists our influence by enlisting communist support. Consider these two examples. One, Laos. In 1958, the CIA spent $310 million in a covert attempt to defeat the communist path at Laos and elect the pro-Western cabinet. Noted journalist Fred Cook wrote in 1961, "The inevitable consequence, once the plot was exposed, was a crushing election victory by the communists, who then used American foreign aid to support communist battalions." Discovery of our operation thus promoted communism, but the CIA was not content. Unable to purchase a pro-Western government, it installed one with a military coup in 1961. Enraged at the United States, and now backed by communist power, the ousted leaders began to carve up the country. In 3 years, America had sacrificed lives to communism, a serious setback in itself. But this defeat also made a long-term contribution to communist strength elsewhere, in Vietnam. The New York Times, April 27, 1966. "Following the CIA fiasco, communist Laotians were never again driven from the border of North Vietnam, and it is through that the Viet Cong have been supplied and replenished." Our second example is Burma. Since 1949, the CIA had directed thousands of nationalist Chinese troops who had seized the Burmese province and were preparing to invade mainland China. When American responsibility was exposed in 1952, Burma abandoned her pro-Western stance, renounced American aid, and moved closer to Peking. The New York Times concluded, "Nothing so helped the communists in Burma as discovery that CIA had directed the colony of nationalist troops. Discovery strengthens communism, and that's our first subpoint. Our second subpoint, discovery injures the innocent. It injures the innocent. When a CIA agent suffers as a result of underhanded tactics, it can be said that he knew what he was getting into. But when innocent people are harmed, people who are unaware that they are part of an international intrigue, then clearly a basic moral standard has been violated, and that we cannot tolerate. Two examples. One, private organization. Using the National Student Association as a propaganda weapon, the CIA secretly funded that organization. Unaware of the source, the NSA gladly accepted the money. Disaster came with discovery. As newsmen dug deeper, hundreds of other private institutions, unions, charities, and churches were identified as unknowing recipients of CIA funds. Professor Richard Hunt of Harvard described the result. The exposure of CIA connections undermined the independence of countless innocent organizations, the work of many private institutions abroad was jeopardized, reputations were injured, careers were shattered, and charitable foundations were shaken. Thus, scores of innocent individuals were gravely injured simply because the CIA chose to use them. But more sinister cases have come to light. Our second example, Berlin, 1954. Taking young and easily influenced students, the CIA plunged them into the explosive post-war German underground, directing them in secret maneuvers in preparation for an invasion of East Germany. When the operation was discovered, it was the students who suffered. Louis Hagen, writing in the Secret War for Europe, notes, "The world had to watch the sad aftermath of the CIA affair, as scores of misled youths were arrested in East Germany as alleged provocateurs and were sentenced to up to 9 years at hard labor." No more than pawns in the Cold War, innocent people suffer, excuse me, as the CIA escapes to plot further operations. Our second subpoint, discovery injures the innocent. But we pay yet another price when covert operations are discovered. Our third subpoint, discovery threatens the peace. It threatens the peace. There is a danger of retaliation whenever the communists discover the origin of plots against them. A perilous incident occurred in Formosa, 1954. The CIA masterminded guerrilla attacks on the Chinese mainland from Taiwan, and the Red Chinese reacted with violence. Fred Cook comments, "Having isolated the origin of the operation, Red China blasted Quemoy and Matsu with heavy artillery. The United States and China had been pushed to the point of open conflict." Mr. Cook concludes, "The world stood dangerously close to total war." Professor Paul Blackstock of Chicago stated our conclusion, "Our covert operations have created major threats to peace." Our first contention, discovery of covert operations undermines American objectives. Our second contention, the only way to prevent discovery is to end all operations. The only way to prevent discovery is to end all operations. Our first subpoint, discovery of some operations is inevitable. Discovery of some is inevitable. Officials in the field, Allied operatives, and the American press have all leaked news of covert operations. And of course, given the nature of our society, with its freedom of speech and press, these sources cannot be silenced. That was the conclusion of President Kennedy, quoted by Theodore Sorensen. Discovery of covert operations, he said, is inevitable in an open society. But communist counterintelligence also guarantees discovery. General Bettel Smith, the late director of the CIA, frankly admitted, "Any agency engaging in covert operations can safely assume that some of its activities will be penetrated and compromised by the enemy. Some operations, therefore, will inevitably be discovered." Of course, the fact that some will be discovered argues only for stricter control to abolish them. Our second subpoint explains why such control is impossible. There is no way to tell in advance which operations will be discovered. There is no way to tell in advance. History proves the point. Obviously, no one would mount an operation knowing full well that it is going to be discovered. Yet, time and again, operations come to light with no consistent pattern of disclosure. They are discovered large and small, at home and abroad, in success and failure. There is no singular characteristic triggering discovery which we can isolate and eliminate. So we cannot control operations to eliminate just the ones that are going to be discovered. If we want to eliminate discovery, we must end all covert operations, good and bad. And the reason we should do so is our third contention. The harms of discovery outweigh the value of continuing all operations. The harms of discovery outweigh the value of continuing all operations. Now, Joel and I realize the CIA has often done what it set out to do. It has overthrown governments and it has fixed elections. But the critical question is, do these activities make any significant contribution to American foreign policy? Two experts, both of whom were associated with the CIA in official capacities, answer no. Turn to Professor Edwin O. Reischauer, President Kennedy's foreign policy advisor. In 1967, he wrote, "The sort of covert activity associated with the CIA is of value only in very weak countries, and even then only for short-range purposes." Or turn to Roger Hilsman, former director of the Bureau of Intelligence. He wrote, "Covert operations are nothing more than a gimmick. In very limited circumstances, they are a supplement to other action, but nothing more." So continuing all operations would make an insignificant contribution to our foreign policy objectives. And yet our first contention indicates that discovery of covert operations significantly undermines those objectives. The conclusion is obvious. Professor Reischauer makes the final judgment. On balance, covert political activities carried out by the CIA are clearly a net loss to the United States. For this reason, he concludes, the CIA should not be engaged in such activities, but should be limited to its original function of intelligence gathering. To that end, Joel and I propose the following plan. One, covert operations will be abolished. Covert operations will be abolished. Two, a court will be established to enforce this law, a court of enforcement. Three, participation in or direction of a covert operation will constitute an act of treason and will be punishable as such. Participation or direction punishable as an act of treason. Still in all, the people started to whisper to one another that what the child said was so. The emperor doesn't have any clothes on. A little child is saying it, and it is true. The emperor began to squirm, and all at once he knew that what the people said was right.
Frankly, I wish I were debating Rich's mother. However, I would like to direct your attention to the gentleman's rationale for change. Before I do so, David has one question. He would like to know who is going to appoint this particular court or commission. With this in mind, consider what the gentlemen from Harvard tell you. They tell you, first of all, that the discovery of covert operations is detrimental. Now, first of all, I would make the observation that the gentlemen really haven't defined discovery for us. What the gentlemen have shown is suspicion. And I would suggest that discovery, in the radical term, that is proving something about the CIA, is nearly impossible. Discovery is nearly impossible. We can turn to the CIA itself, a publication in 1961. It notes that the CIA does not confirm or deny published reports, whether good or bad. Never alibis, never explains its organization, never identifies its personnel, and will not discuss its budget. I would suggest, first of all, that the gentlemen have little more than suspicion throughout the entirety of their examples. They claim that the communists say that the CIA was involved in certain plots to overthrow them. That's quite probable. They do not point out that the CIA admits that these people were operatives, and I think that's a major consideration. With this in mind, consider what the gentleman tells you. He tells you, first of all, that we strengthen communism, and he gives you two examples of where we strengthen communism. I would suggest two basic things. First of all, look at both of the gentlemen's examples, Laos and Burma. And I would suggest in neither state do we have a communist form of government.
First of all, look at the case of layoffs. The gentleman admits that we have a tripartite government that is neutralist. Secondly, look at Burma. I would suggest, number one, Burma is officially neutral. I would suggest, number two, that Burmese neutralism is favorable to the interests of the United States. Let's turn first to Mr. Adolph Barnett on the Council of Foreign Relations in 1960. He notes, since 1958, which I want you to remember is the same year as the supposed CIA operation, a subtle change has been taking place in Burmese neutralism. While continuing to adhere to a policy of non-alignment, Burma's leaders have steadily strengthened their ties with the West. I would indicate, as did Harold Hovey, former director of the Military Assistance Program, 1965, United States military equipment, for example, has been provided to Burma under sales arrangements since 1958 and renewed again in 1961, despite all the supposed strengthening of communism that took place in that particular state. But the gentlemen then go back to Laos and indicate to you that there was a harm in Vietnam. Note the assumption that Harvard makes here. They assume, because Laos now has a three-party government, that the North Vietnamese are capable of infiltrating through Laos. Now, I want the gentleman to indicate to me in any way, shape, form, or fashion that even a pro-United States government could police the entirety of the Laotian jungle and prevent that infiltration. The gentlemen simply don't have a point here. It doesn't necessarily strengthen communism. Number two, the gentlemen tell you that the National Student Association, for example, is an example of where CIA operations involve unknowing persons. Note number one, there's no way of knowing whether they should be involved or not, whether they actually undertook it or not, whether there was actually an operation or not. It is quite possible under this particular proposal for the Soviets or the Chinese or anyone else to claim that anyone in a particular country is involved with the CIA, and there is no way of denying it, either under the affirmative proposal or under the present system. Consider, however, the National Student Association and student movements around the world. I would suggest that we do gain an advantage by subsidizing those particular movements and should maintain that option. Henri de Rincourt, consultant to the Foreign Policy Research Institute in 1968, noted on page 111 of his book, The American Empire. Often enough, the United States assists the enemies of United States allies, and by doing it secretly, avoids antagonizing those allies by keeping options open for future undercutting of communist influence. They note the involvement of students in anti-colonial type rebel movements. I would suggest that's a definite advantage, and I would suggest that the advantages outweigh the gains in that particular point. I think I'm as qualified as Mr. Reischauer to make that particular judgment. Number three, the gentlemen tell you the discovery of particular operations threatens the peace. Now note the example that the gentlemen give you. They give you the example of Formosa. Now note, the Chinese on the mainland and the Chinese on Formosa have been carrying on those particular operations fighting against each other since 1946. I don't think the CIA created the enmity between Chiang and Mao. I indicate, number two, that we would require some utilization of intelligence research over Red China, and I indicate, number three, to you, that it is quite probable that spies would be treated the same way as guerrillas. Note that the gentleman talks only about the shellings. He in no way proves, number one, that CIA agents were actually involved. He in no way proves that Chiang Kai-shek couldn't send guerrilla operations over there anyway, and the world still wouldn't be pushed to war. I don't think Harvard has a warrant in this particular contention. But here the gentlemen present their most important contention. They tell you that in order to prevent discovery, we must end all covert operations. And here the gentlemen tell you that operatives can be detected. And note what the gentlemen say here. They say that operatives in this particular operation can be detected by similar operatives. Now the question arises in my mind, as I'm sure it does in yours, exactly why we alienate everyone, exactly why we harm the innocent, exactly why we alienate these countries, when the Soviet Union does the same thing in a particular field, and I think we need to maintain the option for that particular reason. Mr. Rincourt previously cited 1968. Since it is difficult to fight an opponent without using its own best weapons, Americans were driven to some extent to duplicate the Soviet apparatus for conducting covert operations. I would suggest we need to counterbalance it. I would also suggest once again, and this is most important, that anyone can be called by anyone else an operative, and there is no way to disprove that, even under Harvard's proposal, because it's not going to do much good to a Soviet police agent to show him a copy of the new law. All right, now consider the second basic point. Here the gentlemen tell you, and I want you to note this, this is a subjective value judgment that the gentlemen make. They tell you that the harms of covert operations and the discovery of covert operations outweigh the gains. Let's consider some of the gains. First of all, let's consider a general trend, and I think this is particularly important. Mr. Henri de Rincourt previously cited 1968. It is certain that an increasing number of covert operations are carried out with considerable success. Past successes testify eloquently, although they are less publicized with favor. We are suggesting, therefore, that there is an increasing trend on the part of the United States covert operations to be more effective. The gentlemen simply make that particular judgment on the basis of past failures. Note, at no time does either their authority or the gentleman from Harvard actually draw the correlation between the two. They say, here's the political value, here's the political loss. Harvard cannot make that particular moral judgment. But just to show you that we're not short on moral judgments ourselves, I would suggest to you that we have an authority that's just as good as Mr. Reischauer to suggest to you that there is a reason and that the actual cost-benefits ratio is in favor of the present system. Here we turn to Mr. Charles Jacob, professor of political science at Vassar in 1966. He notes that the CIA has at times been misinformed is obvious, but this is a hazard common to all governmental agencies. To suggest that the covert operations of the CIA be abolished or even closely scrutinized by normal governmental agencies is to deprive ourselves of an unpleasant necessity in the era of the Cold War. I suggest that Harvard makes this particular value judgment. Now let me document some of the successes. We turn once again to Mr. Reinkort in 1968. He notes in the case of Indonesia, there is a distinct possibility during the coup of 1965 that the CIA had a distinct connection between the opponents of President Sukarno, forcing him to do what they did. Consider his conclusion. It is plausible to assume that the CIA might have had a finger in the Indonesian pie when President Sukarno was overthrown in the 1965 military takeover. It is naive to assume that the CIA, after attempts to overthrow Sukarno in 1958 and at other times, had nothing to do with the coup. I would suggest Indonesia is pretty important. The gentlemen tell you it's only small areas. Remember that Indonesia is one of the major areas in the Southeast Asian island chain, has oil resources, etc., and was in danger of communist takeover. Now look at our own hemisphere. I would suggest we had been successful there, too. Turn to Mr. Armiger Reinkort, previously cited. In 1962 and 63, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees had turned over its International Affairs Department as a base for strikes and subversive activities aimed at the overthrow of Chedi Jagan's proto-communist regime in British Guiana, which was duly accomplished in 1964, thus avoiding a new Cuba in the Western Hemisphere. The gentlemen give you examples, we give you examples. The gentlemen give you a conclusionary piece of evidence, we give you a conclusionary piece of evidence. The basic difference is this: that Harvard cannot guarantee that their particular harms will necessarily be met by the adoption of their proposal. We can guarantee some successes in the future. We can guarantee a probability that those successes will be good. We have to take the criticism either way. We suggest, therefore, the basis for United States policy should be to gain the most advantage from covert operations, which are necessary, and that we can do with the present system.
Rich and I are pleased to be debating the affirmative today. In 1492, Columbus discovered America. Since 1947, the United States has been discovered again and again and again. And because Rich and I don't want to see the United States running around naked, we resolved that executive control should be curtailed. The gentleman begins with a question: who appoints the court? I hadn't thought of it. Perhaps the Supreme Court could do it. If Mike or Dave want to presume that perhaps the president would appoint him, they may do so. Secondly, they suggest that discovery is impossible because there's no way in the world to tie these events that we discuss with you to the Central Intelligence Agency. Let me indicate initially that all the examples which we use in the affirmative case have been admitted to by the former director of the CIA, Alan Dulles, in his book, The Craft of Intelligence. We were careful to choose the examples in that way. Number two, we admit to Mike that there is a fine line between discovery and accusation. We think we can perhaps establish what that distinction is by demonstrating that unless an activity is proven to be associated with the CIA, it won't produce the harms which we've discussed with you. For example, in the NSA, Professor Hunt writes in 1968, actually there were ironies in the timing of the clamor. A year before, in April of 1966, the New York Times had published a three-part series of articles on the CIA. Although these articles had systematically set forth the scope of CIA infiltration of private American institutions, they had produced no significant public reaction. The public reaction came when it was proved conclusively that the United States was associated. It's a fine distinction, but I think we can make it. Then the gentleman deals specifically with the affirmative case, the first contention of which was that discovery of covert operations undermines American objectives, the first subpoint of which was that discovery strengthens communism in two ways through two examples. The gentleman responds by dealing first with Laos and says that Laos is not communist today, but rather tri-communist, that is, only one-third of a country is communist. Now, that's true, but we said that the third of a country that is controlled by the communists is being used to supply and replenish the rebels in North Vietnam, and that is the harm. We suggest that that harm, or the result of a tripartite country, was the result of the CIA discovery, and note, please, that Mike does not reject that causal link. Therefore, we've established the harm for you. Mike says, second, however, with respect to Laos, prove to us that we could have controlled the area and prevented the infiltration. I think that's Mike's burden to prove. He's got to show us that if we had allowed Suvarnabhumi to keep control of the entire country, he could have prevented, or could not have prevented, the Laotians from getting the stranglehold of the country that they have today. We've indicated that that problem was the direct result of the coup. If Mike rejects that indication, he's got to prove it. Second, with respect to Burma, Mike's only analysis is to indicate to us that Burma is neutral today. I suppose if we could prove to you that Japan bombed Pearl Harbor because of a covert operation, which admittedly we can't, Mike would get up and say, well, that's no problem because Japan's our ally today. The point is that in the short run, it was disastrous. We demonstrate from our evidence in the first speech that nothing so strengthened the communists as the CIA fiasco. The gentlemen tell us that the reason that the CIA goes into these areas is to preclude a communist takeover, then turn around and tell us that there's nothing wrong with a communist takeover or with communist inclinations. We suggest they're being inconsistent. But let me add a final example to the examples we give you. We suggest we strengthen communism in 1961 due to the Bay of Pigs invasion. H. Bradford Westerfield of Yale writes, communism simply tightened its grip in Cuba, if not Indonesia, after the local government's victory over the United States in subliminate war. We suggest we strengthen communism. Two, we injure the innocent. Note, please, Mike does not deny the significance of the harm. He implicitly or tacitly admits to you that it is harmful to undermine careers, etc., and it is harmful to throw scores of people into jail for 9 years of hard labor in East Berlin. He admits then the significance of the affirmative harm. He says two things. One, he repeats his analysis that the CIA might not have been involved. I've already demonstrated Dulles admits to it. But number two, he suggests perhaps we got an advantage. Doesn't tell us how and reads no evidence. Let me turn first to Professor Hunt. He writes, the CIA was debilitating the personal and institutional standards in America for the sake of a dubious advantage abroad. Senator J. William Fulbright tells us how dubious that advantage was. International youth conferences and festivals are not nearly so important as the NSA and its CIA benefactors would have thought. Hence, it has always been unlikely that either Russian communists or American Democrats would convert the other. Presumably, the importance of these meetings was to sway the minds of the uncommitted, which would have had to be fairly feeble, that's Fulbright's language, to be permanently won over to one ideology or the other by flattery or the hoopla characterized by the CIA. We don't think we got any advantage, and we challenge Mike to prove it. He does not deny the harm that we do injure people. Let me add another example. The gentleman tells us about British Guiana. We injured innocents there. According to Richard J. Barnett of the Institute for Policy Studies, mobs roamed the streets attacking people of Indian ancestry. Over 50 people were injured and others were killed. The violence was instigated by a terrorist group financed by the CIA. We suggest it's harmful when we injure innocent people. Third, we threaten the peace. The gentleman does not deny the conclusion from Professor Blackstock that the discovery of covert operations in general threatens the peace. We think that's monstrously significant. But with respect to the one example of Formosa, Mike has one response. He says, number one, we've always been fighting Formosa, but we never came to the brink of war as we did, except for the CIA coup. The gentleman is not responsive to our harm. Number two, he suggests to you that perhaps by catching spies we can threaten the peace. I'd like the gentleman to prove that to you. Prove that the discovery of intelligence operatives would threaten nuclear or total war. I don't think Mike can prove that. And finally, the gentleman says, look, Chang would have probably attacked China anyway. That in no way indicates that we would have drawn the United States into the conflict. We indicate a power struggle between communist China and the United States. Mike's assertion notwithstanding. Let me add another example to this one, the Bay of Pigs. James Rustin writes, in November of 1964, Kennedy said just enough to convince me that Khrushchev had studied the Bay of Pigs fiasco and had decided on that basis that he was dealing with an inexperienced young leader who could be intimidated and blackmailed. The communist decision to put offensive missiles into Cuba was the final gamble of that assumption. The Bay of Pigs brought us to the brink of thermonuclear disaster. That supports the conclusion of Professor Blackstock. Covert operations are detrimental. Their discovery threatens the peace. Second, the only way to prevent discovery is to end all operations. Mike does not deny the contention. He makes two arguments, but neither of them deny the contention. And the contention is crucial. It says that we cannot just keep the good examples that Mike told us about Indonesia and British Guiana. We have to keep the bad ones, too. Therefore, we have to make a value judgment, and that's our third contention. What two points did Mike make? First of all, he suggests to us, why would we harm ourselves when the Soviets are not harming themselves, and don't we need counterintelligence, etc.? First of all, discovery of Soviet operations doesn't harm them because they're not supposed to be an open society. We expect them to do such things. We're harmed because of the very nature of American society, according to President Kennedy, whom we quoted in the first speech. But number two, we suggest we can counter the Soviets, and there's a better way to do it than covert operations. That was the conclusion of former Assistant Secretary of State Harlan Cleveland in 1961. The best answer, underline the word best, to the stealthy Soviet practice of indirect aggression is not reciprocal stealth, but the highlight of publicity. If the Soviets are doing anything, we need only expose them. The gentleman in no way indicates we're harming a precious ally. Second, the gentleman suggests that that claims or allegations can cause the same problems. I think he'd better prove that. I'd like him to show us that claims can threaten the peace, strengthen the communists, and injure the innocent. We give you the example of the National Student Association, in which a year before the discovery, the New York Times made many claims, but nothing came of it. Only the proof that the CIA is involved can cause the harms which we discuss. Mike is in no way responsive to that position. Third, the harms of discovery outweigh the value of continuing all operations. Mike makes three points. Number one, he suggests to you that the number of successes is increasing, never telling you why. Let me read general evidence, first about the purpose of our interventions, and second about their success. The purpose, of course, is to preclude a communist takeover, yet Professor Paul Blackstock of Chicago writes in 1964, the perennial struggle against Soviet communism or other revolutionary movements will not be won by covert operations, which seek, however, successfully to do no more than thwart threatened seizures of power or merely to overthrow a communist regime. We can't stop communism. What about the successes? Richard Cotton of Pittsburgh writes, the evidence in most cases of success suggests that the element of good luck was extraordinarily important. We suggest we can't guarantee success. Number three, Fred Cook writes, the Nation, all the CIA successes dealt with intelligence and intelligence only. There is no unique benefit to covert operations. Now Mike then gives us three arguments. First, he quotes Mr. Jacobs, who simply says that we need to keep the CIA. Mr. Jacobs does not make the value judgment. He is only saying that he thinks, and he is a professor, not an expert who is associated in official capacities with the CIA, that covert operations are valuable. We've denied that allocation. The only sources in today's debate who indicate that the harms outweigh the benefits, or who make a judgment on that value, is Professor Reischauer, who is associated with the CIA, and he makes the evaluation. But Mike gives us two examples of successes. Number one, we helped in Indonesia. Turn to William Stillman and Pfaff at the Huston Institute, writing in 1966. In the late 50s, the U.S. supported an unsuccessful rebellion in Indonesia against President Sukarno, and the effect was to provide gratuitous grounds for anti-American sentiments and pro-communist political policies in Indonesia for the decade following. We suggest it was harmful. Now, if Mike is suggesting that the CIA had something to do with the recent attempt on the coup of Indonesia in 1968, I suggest he prove it and demonstrate to us what the value was, and demonstrate to us that these people couldn't have succeeded in the coup without the CIA. Then he suggests British Guiana, never telling us there was a threat. Professor Barnett writes, although a Marxist in outlook, Jagan had made no move to become part of the Soviet orbit. There was no threat. Mike suggests perhaps he was becoming another Cuba. I like the language because Barnett uses it too. There is no evidence that Jagan was about to make a Cuba of his country. Finally, why was Arbenz leaning towards the communists? According to Barnett, just as Arbenz in Guatemala 5 years earlier had under pressure turned increasingly to the Soviet bloc, so Jagan tried to get assistance from the only government willing to defy the United States. There was no threat in British Guiana. Rather, there were riots that killed and injured people. I don't think the gentleman can establish the value of the CIA.
I'd like to direct your attention to the affirmative proposal. Consider first, the gentleman's analysis has been solely restricted to the Central Intelligence Agency, yet their plan completely prohibits all covert operations. Apparently, they're implying that some other agency engages in such activities, yet they've completely failed to indict any activities other than those suspected of the Central Intelligence Agency. As the Fleming Professor of International Relations at Vanderbilt points out from 1968, since the Bay of Pigs fiasco, the actual handling of subversive operations appears to have been transferred to the Defense Department, which may, for example, develop guerrilla forces within a communist state. Note that the gentleman's analysis is considered only those instances of the Central Intelligence Agency. They haven't considered those by other functionaries. Secondly, the gentleman's analysis is by no means unique to executive control, and I'd like to stress the point. That is that their analysis indicts a policy of executing covert operations. They don't indict executive control of covert operations, hence I would suggest that their particular analysis is outside the purview of this particular resolution. Thirdly, and I think this is crucial, the gentlemen have never proven themselves that the harms that they've claimed are inherent exclusively to covert operations. Now, they say, obviously, they couldn't occur from spying, but they don't ever prove their inherent burden of proof to show that their harms derive only from the covert operations, the tampering aspects of such functions. Consider, first of all, the strengthening of communism. I would suggest that whether or not we conduct covert operations, that we're going to be blamed for them anyway, and the propaganda value, which correspondingly supposedly results in the strengthening of communism, can continue to remain. Turn, first of all, to Lyman B. Kirkpatrick, former director of CIA in 1968. Even if the United States and the CIA did not engage in any such activity, it would still be blamed for it by the communists. There is validity to this. Former Indonesian Foreign Minister Subandrio, in his trial in 1966, admitted that he used the CIA as a scapegoat for the most of the ills of his country. Secondly, consider the New York Times study of the CIA in 1966. Through spurious reports, gossip, misunderstandings, deep-seated fears, and forgeries and falsifications, the agency has been accused of almost anything anyone wanted to accuse it of. They list the following: plotting the assassination of Jawaharlal Nehru of India, provoking the 1965 war between India and Pakistan, engineering the plot that became the pretext for the murder of the leading Indonesian generals last year, supporting the rightist army plots in Algeria, murdering Patrice Lumumba in the Congo, kidnapping Moroccan agents in Paris, and plotting the overthrow of President Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana. The point being, they can accuse the Central Intelligence Agency of doing just about anything. It's still going to exist. It'll still be engaging in those intelligence operations. I want the gentleman to explain why that can continue to supposedly encourage communism. They've given us no analysis. Secondly, consider that simply terminating operations in the present doesn't necessarily alleviate the harm. Consider the gentleman's example of Burma. Turn to the New York Times study once again. Moreover, some of the nationalist Chinese are still in northern Burma, years later, and still fomenting trouble and infuriating governments in that area, although they have not been supported by the CIA or any American agency for a decade. Now, the gentlemen are assuming we're carrying on a lot of operations today. Suppose we stop our support for them. In Burma, we stopped the support, but their harms supposedly continued after we were no longer engaging in them. They can't guarantee solution of that harm simply by terminating current operations. Consider next the supposed harm to innocence. And I'd like to know exactly why, if the Central Intelligence Agency goes into a country, bribes innocent people to help them engage in spying, that they too can't be sentenced to life in some communist prison camp or something else. The gentlemen make a dichotomous assumption that there is a difference between covert operations and spying in the minds of the people who persecute those innocents, yet they never justify that supposed assumption. I'd like to know why communist governments are going to punish people engaged in covert operations who are innocent, but they aren't going to punish people who are engaged in such things as spying. The gentlemen have never given us the reasoning. Next, consider threats to the peace. The gentlemen say, obviously, spies can't threaten the peace. Once again, no reasoning why that inherent assumption is valid. Consider the following scenario. In the situation in the 1961 situation in the U-2 overflight, isn't it possible that that which was a spying mission could have resulted in a nuclear war? A miscalculation on Soviet radars, supposedly according to their possibility justification, could have led them to believe they were under some form of an attack. In other words, the act of spying itself could be considered by the Soviet Union or a communist government to be a threat to its security and hence a threat to the peace. But I want to stress the overall line of analysis. That is that the gentlemen have given us no reason to assume that their inherent assumption is correct, that there is a difference or that it would be perceived as such a difference. Consider the next argument. That is that it's impossible to separate intelligence from operations. Now, the gentlemen say that we should let the Central Intelligence Agency do that which it is best at and that which it is designed for, the gathering of intelligence. I would maintain, however, that it's impossible to distinguish between covert operations and the gathering of intelligence, on a practical basis. Consider after the New York Times study in 66. For information gathering often spills over at the scene of action into something else. Subversion, counteractivity, sabotage, political and economic intervention, and other kinds of dirty tricks. Often the intelligence gatherer, by design or force of circumstances, becomes an activist in these affairs that he was set to watch. They conclude, in these and dozens of other instances, an agent who is merely ostensibly gathering intelligence is in reality an activist attempting to create or resolve a situation. Now the gentlemen assume that you can take the two and separate them. Their own New York Times study indicates that you can't. Now the question becomes, is this on-the-spot intelligence vital to the overall intelligence network? Granted, most of our intelligence comes from open sources. Yet to be made meaningful, it requires this on-the-spot activist influence to make the meaningful interpretations possible. Turn to the New York Times study for their conclusion. 4 of every 5 of these items, it is said, now come from either open sources or inanimate devices. But in many important instances, it is still the human agent alerted to make a particular arrangement or to chase a specific piece of information who provides the link that makes all else meaningful and significant. Sometimes, now as in the 18th century, it is men alone who do the job in danger and difficulty. I would suggest then that there's no assurance that you can practically separate the two functions. Next, I would suggest that if we accept the gentleman's analysis, consider the likely result. Now they make an assumption that the United States wants to interfere in other states. We have an interest in doing so because apparently that's why we try to accomplish these goals using covert operations. If the gentlemen deny covert operations to the policymakers, they do nothing about the motivation or the desire to interfere in other states, and I suggest the logical recourse is the use of overt intervention. They say, let's don't respond through stealth. What's the likely result going to be? Response through an overt intervention, which is on the whole worse. Consider it Stanley Hoffman, professor of government at Harvard in 1968. The less overt the American intervention and the more tenuous the link between the revolutionaries and the United States, the more lasting the success of offense or components will be, that the forces that brought it off will appear genuinely national. Consider as did H.B. Westerfield, professor of political science at Yale in 1963. Outright military intervention is vastly more repugnant to articulate opinion in most parts of the world than are the other techniques for manipulating politics abroad. Consider their specific analysis. Threats to innocence, threats to the peace. If the United States can't send a few covert operatives in, and we have to send a full-scale military intervention in, that's going to harm innocent people and threaten the peace far more than the simple covert operation. Consider Vietnam. There we kill innocents by bombing them. It isn't on the same magnitude as a covert operation. Consider the threat to peace. We have actual military forces engaged in an overt intervention. We don't simply have covert operatives as occurs in the present system. Consider now the gentleman's analysis on the option of covert interventions. Here I would suggest that they have a fundamental fallacy. Notice, unless we can tell every single operation of a covert nature that the CIA has conducted and examine it, we can't make their value judgment. What the gentlemen do is say, well, we realize you can't do that, so let's go to the people involved in the covert operations themselves. They never proved Mr. Reischauer actually was on that CIA board. They never proved Mr. Reischauer was connected with the Central Intelligence Agency. Sure, he was connected with foreign policy. They didn't demonstrate that he knew about every single one of those covert operations and could make that authoritative value judgment. So, it becomes a question of evaluating the authorities that they did present. Let's start with Mr. Hillsman, 1964. Dulles justifies our covert political activities on similar grounds. As long as the communist countries continue to use subversive means to bring down non-communist regimes, those who oppose the communists must be prepared to meet the threat. But meeting it successfully, Dulles argues, means that our intelligence services must play their role early in the struggle while the subversion is still in the plotting and organizing stage. Mr. Dulles seems to think that on balance we ought to keep those covert operations. But let me read Mr. Hillsman's conclusion, the affirmative's own source. In both these arguments, it seems to me Dulles is fundamentally right. So long as the communists themselves are openly antagonistic to the rest of the world, as they openly and avowedly are, and so long as they use the techniques of subversion to bring down governments, which they do and which they openly and avowedly advocate doing, he suggests we should retain that covert operation potential. That's the point. We can turn for further support to another man intimately connected with the Central Intelligence Agency, Mr. Lyman B. Kirkpatrick in 1968. There is little question that the United States government needs a capability for covert action to fight its enemies. I suggest then, thirdly, by turning to Mr. H. H. Ransom, professor of political science at Vanderbilt, who concluded in 64, our new world position demands an instrument for counterintelligence and secret political action overseas. In conclusion, then, I don't think the gentlemen have really given a significant harm. The harms they have given have not been demonstrated to be inherent solely in covert operations. They also accrue from intelligence, or potentially could accrue. Thirdly and finally, they've never assured us that the harms which they supposedly would eliminate with their plan would not be outweighed by the substitution of another foreign policy tool upon its acceptance.
I'd like to return your attention to the gentleman's affirmative. First of all, they tell you that the discovery of covert operations is harmful. I argue that the discovery, de facto, is impossible, but the accusations cause the same problems. Here the gentleman posits two arguments. He says, first of all his examples are referred to by Alan Dulles. I suggest the gentleman read absolutely nothing from Alan Dulles. That's merely an assertion on his part. Secondly, if he's accepting Mr. Dulles, he ought to accept Mr. Dulles' value judgment about the CIA, because I know he's connected. All right, now consider the second argument. The gentleman says there's a fine line between the threat of involvement of the CIA or the imaginement of involvement of the CIA and the actual CIA operation. I suggest that such is not the case. The mere threat or the imaginary presence of the CIA can cause every harm that the gentleman talked about. They challenged me for an example. Here comes a big goodie. Our Meteor Rhinecourt consultant to the Foreign Policy Research Institute in 1968 noted that the mere threat, real or imaginary, of CIA underground action in the Middle East, the actualization of a coup in Greece, was enough to influence the overheated imaginations of the Egyptian leaders in Cairo with the result of the Six-Day War of 1967. The imaginary involvement of the CIA has all the same harms. There's the gentleman's example. Consider now the gentleman's contentions. They tell you, number one, that our particular CIA policy strengthens communism. Now look first at both examples. Neither in Laos nor in Burma do we have a communist government. In Laos, they claim that a third of the country belongs to the communists. No, a third of the government belongs to the communists, and a third of the government belongs to us, according to Mr. Arthur J. Noman, Laos and Conflict, 1964. General Fumi, a member of that tripartite committee, is in deep sympathy with reforms, a sympathy that is encouraged by the Central Intelligence Agency. The other part is neutral, and finally, the gentlemen contend that we have to prove that they can stop that particular infiltration in Laos. They can't. They got their own problems, and the CIA has nothing to do with it. I would suggest, first of all, this is Mr. Richard Butwell, professor of international relations at American University. Without American help in the forms of equipment, training, advisors, and bombing, Laos would not exist as an independent state today. They've got enough problems on their own without patrolling the borders looking for more North Vietnamese. The gentleman can't carry that particular harm. Number two, Burma. The gentleman has one response. He said it was short-term. I turned to Mr. Barnett. He said, since 1958. That's the same year. It must have been a pretty short term. I don't think the gentleman really shows any significant harm. Thirdly, he brings up a new example, the Bay of Pigs, and here he tells you the Bay of Pigs caused the threat of war. I suggest it did, but not necessarily because it was a covert operation, because it wasn't enough of a covert operation. Norman A. Bailey of the Georgetown Center for Strategic Studies, 1966. The evidence indicates that the Soviet Union, while delighted at the embarrassment of Cuba was causing the United States, did not expect to retain its new client until Kennedy's administration's failure to support the Bay of Pigs intervention. This convinced the Soviet they could use it for international purposes, not necessarily just the use of the covert information. All right, consider now the second point. The gentleman tells you that it injures the innocent. Here, first of all, they say that Dulles admits it. I didn't hear it. Secondly, the gentleman tell you that the CIA gains are dubious. Now, recall the information I made from Mr. Rhinecourt. It said we were subsidizing anti-colonials. At the same time, we were not engaging in any activities which our allies could perceive and hate us. We were getting the best of both worlds, and the gentleman doesn't deny it. He again reads a conclusionary piece of evidence. However, he says during the coup that took place in British Guiana, some people were killed. So what? The gentleman doesn't prove that that coup would not have taken any way. He doesn't prove that the CIA was in actuality killing those people to just stir up some trouble. I don't think the gentleman really carries the argument. Thirdly, the gentleman tells you that we threaten the peace. He has one example besides the Bay of Pigs, which I've already dealt with, and that is the example of Formosa, and I suggest in the example of Formosa, we did not have the risk of nuclear war. C.M. Brown of UCLA concludes with me in 1968. We easily faced down the Chinese in the Quemoy-Matsu conflict without running any high risk. But note secondly, the stimulating factor was guerrilla attacks by Chiang Kai-shek. Now, we've been telling Chiang Kai-shek to get off the Chinese backs for the last 10 years, and he won't do it. That crisis still would have come about without the CIA, and the gentlemen don't deny that crucial line of argument. Consider now the third contention, that to prevent discovery, you have to end all CIA operations. They talk about value judgments. The first thing they say is we shouldn't do it because we have an open society. Now, really, if the gentlemen are concerned about people dying, I think we ought to counterbalance those communist terrorist tactics. And so does Roger Hilsman of Columbia in 1964. The governments to which they are so hostile have a right and a duty to maintain the methods of secret intelligence to protect and defend themselves. The gentleman then says we ought to expose their stuff. Now, wait a minute. We can scream commie all day long. Who's going to believe us? The gentleman never quantify that particular point. We can counter their stealth with more stealth and be effective.
Thirdly, the gentleman tells you that there are harms to discovery and they outweigh the risks. Recall, I give you the example of Indonesia. The gentleman wants the importance of Indonesia. It contains 30% of the mineral resources that we utilized in the Second World War. The gentleman wants to know if that was the coup of 1965. It is. I'll leave him the evidence. On balance, the conclusion of those involved with the CIA is in favor of its retention.
In overtime, Michael got back to his two examples of successful covert operations. Indonesia. He reads this evidence very hurriedly that does not answer Joel's point. Number one, that we are unsuccessful. Number two, we tighten the communist grip. Second of all, in British Guiana, Joel said the man was not a Soviet. It was not going to become another Cuba, and we drove him to the communists. This is crucial. If the gentlemen are going to make a value judgment, there's got to be something for them to put on their side of the scale. That was all they had going into rebuttal, and Mike dropped it in his speech. Now observe the plan objection. Number one, that we don't indict anybody but the Central Intelligence Agency. That's not true. We indict all covert operations. Our second and third contentions apply to them. Second, we don't indict executive control. Of course we do. The executive authorized covert operations. If we stop him from that authorization, we've reduced his control. Thirdly, we never prove the harms are unique to covert operations. That's true. We tell you one very simple thing. There are harms from covert operations and no countervailing benefits. The gentleman doesn't respond to that. Then he goes through our four harms, stops at accusations, and said that Subandrio accused us in the Middle East. We ask him what was the harm to that. The gentleman doesn't tell us. Then we point to the NSA example. The gentleman doesn't respond to it. Then he talks about Burma, and he says the Chinese are still there. Obviously, Joel and I can't solve the examples we've talked about. Those harms have already occurred. We're going to prevent future situations. Secondly, the gentleman talks about harming the innocent and completely asserts to you that spying can cause the same harms. The gentleman never gives us an example. Also, however, if the gentleman is right and spying can cause the same harms, he doesn't make the value judgment. Intelligence is crucial to the United States. Therefore, if there are harms to intelligence gathering, they're worth it. We should incur the harms. We should not incur the harms in covert operations because there's nothing to balance them. There aren't any benefits. The gentleman doesn't make the value judgment with respect to intelligence. Fourth, the gentleman said we'll threaten the peace, then gives you a scenario using the U-2. It's an absolute assertion, absolutely no evidence indicating it might be true. Fourth, the gentleman says you can't separate intelligence from operations and makes two arguments. A, they often spill over. They spill over because covert operations are legal. If they are illegal and you can be punished for treason, we suggest the operative won't let it spill over. Mike doesn't deal with that. Second of all, he says information gathered in covert operations is vital. That's not true. Professor Harry Howe Ransom says operational commanders notoriously come to view a plan as an end in itself. A distorted view of reality always results. The information we get from covert operations is distorted. It is not useful information. Dave doesn't deal with that. Then he says we're going to intervene overtly. Look, why does the United States intervene covertly? Because we're afraid if we're discovered, something disastrous is going to happen. That can be the only rationale for being sneaky. Now Dave is telling us Kennedy would have invaded the Bay of Pigs. We would have announced that we were supplying the Chinese in Burma. We would have announced that we were infiltrating the NSA. Covert and overt are not interchangeable, and Dave never suggested that they were. To the top of the flow sheet where Mike makes two arguments. One, he says our thing about Dulles is an assertion. It is not. All the examples are documented in Dulles' book. Number two, he said if you accept Mr. Dulles there, you've got to accept his value judgment. No, we'll accept what he said he does. We won't claim what he says that what he did was beneficial because it was not. Then Mike once again says, Look at their examples in strengthening communism. Only one-third of Laos is under communist control, but that's the one-third that has been supplying North Vietnam. Two, he says the U.S. is also supporting the Laotians and they couldn't stop it. Yes, they could. What we're saying here is because they're in firm control of the country, they have access to all the supplies in the country, and they're being shipped directly into North Vietnam, the gentleman doesn't deny the harm. Second, on Burma. He says it was short-term. We say, yes, it was, but it was harmful. We were trying to stop communism, and we promoted it. What was the value of Burma? The gentleman doesn't tell us. What was the harm? We were counterproductive in our objectives. Second, on the Bay of Pigs. He said it didn't cause war. All right, admit it didn't cause war. We said it strengthened Castro, and Mike doesn't deal with that. Harming the innocent. He said British Guiana wasn't caused by the CIA. Do you recall Joel's evidence? Terrorism supported by the CIA sparked riots. It was a link. The link did exist, and British Guiana was of no value. Threatening the peace. He said in Formosa, we faced down the Chinese. We certainly did. We said to the Chinese, we're going to blow you up if you don't back down. If the Chinese had not backed down, we would have blown them up, and they would have blown up a significant part of us, too. The covert operation did nothing but threaten war. Second, he said we still had crisis. We could have still had the crisis. That's true, but the U.S. would not have been involved. Therefore, there couldn't have been the threat of war. Mike does not deal with the analysis. He says we must counter the communists. We say let's expose them. Mike asserts it won't work. We call the evidence that we read. Finally, he said Mr. Hilsman comes out in favor of the negative. Mr. Hilsman does not. Covert operations are nothing more than a gimmick. Joel and I don't think we should perpetuate gimmicks. In the last 5 minutes of his career, I think Mr. Cycle has a lot of questions to answer, and if he does not, I think we should abolish covert operations.
Like to try my best to live up to Rich's expectations. First, concerning discovery. We turned, first of all, and examined their analysis of Mr. Dulles. We said they assert Dulles documents all those. The gentleman repeats his assertion, never demonstrating the point. But get this. They're willing to accept Dulles' testimony on what he does, but not whether or not it works. I want them to justify that position. The dichotomy has never been proven. Next, consider the crucial issue that Mike pointed out that was never even considered in the first rebuttal. That being, the mere imaginary threat of CIA action sparked the war in Israel and Egypt in last year. The gentleman never really denied that analysis. He simply overlooked it. I claim a definite harm which can result simply from that imagined involvement, a crucial issue. Consider next that it undermines objectives, first of all, strengthening of communism. Now note the most important thing. In none of those areas in which we used a covert operation did a communist government result. Consider Laos. The gentlemen say, now wait a minute, they're actually controlling this country and actually providing for this infiltration. 2 points. Number one, the reason they can't stop it is because of overall indigenous problems, which the gentlemen don't deny. Most importantly, it's not the Laotians that are doing the shipping, as Rich pointed out, but rather the North Vietnamese that are using it as a circular route into South Vietnam, something that was never denied. Consider next on the Bay of Pigs, or consider in Burma, that in fact we've had those better relations since 1958, and the gentleman doesn't extend on that example. Concerning the Bay of Pigs, they admit we had no real threat of nuclear war since it never materialized. But the important issue is this. That thing, if we used a little more force in that covert operation, if we backed it a little more, we could have succeeded and they wouldn't have considered us to be weaklings in that situation and wouldn't have put those missiles in Cuba. Analysis the gentlemen don't counter. Consider Mr. Reinkort's testimony unanswered. Now we come to Guiana. The gentleman claimed that in Indonesia, that coup could have taken place anyway. Well, then that same terrorism and coup could have taken place anywhere in Guiana. If you accept that reasoning, I suggest an inconsistency. Next on Formosa. The gentleman said we threatened to blow the Chinese up and that's why they backed down. If they hadn't backed down, they would have blown us up. Number one, he asserts that we threatened to use nuclear weapons in that situation against China, but the important consideration is what could China have done? They didn't have any nuclear weapons in 1957. How could they have blown us up, as he asserted in the second part of that statement? Consider next, concerning their second and third contentions. We found, according to Mr. Hilsman, that he thinks we ought to retain that option. Now, he may think they're a gimmick on one page, but on another page, he agrees with Dulles' testimony, that being that for those two reasons, we ought to keep the option to counter communist offensives through covert operations. Mr. Hilsman said, in effect, that we should keep that option, and the gentlemen don't deny the point. Next,
We found out exposure, according to the gentleman, would work to counter communist offenses, never explaining how, why, when, or where that exposure has actually worked. Consider next on Indonesia. We turn to the example in 1965. The gentleman says we didn't sustain our point. Mike demonstrates the importance of the area. Concerning Guyana, the gentleman once again reasserts his point. I've already demonstrated the inconsistency of their analysis. Consider now the plan objections. First of all, they indict only CIA operations. He said, no, we indict all operations. No, you don't, because every single one of your examples is a CIA operation. I want you to prove that all of your analysis applies to the DIA as well. That's something you failed to do. Secondly, that it's not unique to executive control. He said the executive authorizes it. And sure he does. The point is that they're indicting the policy and not the control itself, and that's the dichotomy that was never considered. Next, that the harms are not inherent to operations, they can also result from spying. Here we found, first of all, that we could be blamed anyway. And the gentleman doesn't deny the point, that they can accuse us and blame us for those things. We saw the precedent in the Middle East. We also saw that that could be used for propaganda value. Next, the gentleman says, where's the value in favor of that intelligence? That was pointed out by the New York Times study, which suggested it's necessary to make the overall intelligence pattern meaningful. Next, he talked about the National Student Association. And I would suggest here that same harm could have occurred. Turn to Newsweek, February 27, 67. The CIA funneled $3 million to the NSA since 1952. What it bought was principally a credible public U.S. counterpoint to the communist and world student affairs, plus some discreetly private intelligence reports on rising young political leaders abroad. We could have still affected those innocents in that case. Simply say the reason we're buying them off is to get us intelligence reports that the gentleman's same example could have resulted even with their plan. Thirdly, threats to the peace. And here concerning the innocents also, the gentleman said I didn't give any examples. Now look what's wrong with the reasoning. The reasoning is the country is going to be suspicious of things like overflight, and that's one example of spying which could be misinterpreted. Secondly, they can also be just as suspicious of spies as they are of people who are operatives and condemn them to death. The gentleman doesn't deny the analysis. We can't separate. The gentleman says it's going to be illegal. That's fine. It's inherent in the process of intelligence that it spills over, not in the statutory construction, which the gentleman misses. Next, I suggested that we would increase reliance upon overt intervention, and get this. The gentleman says the reason we use covert operations is because we're afraid. He doesn't prove the point. Look, we use covert operations today because we tried them first, and then if they fail, we can use an overt intervention. But the gentleman removed the first half of the option. They force us to go directly to overt intervention. They don't remove the desire to affect the internal structure of other countries. I suggest they can't guarantee either an advantage, meeting of a need, or the removal of serious disadvantages.
Let me begin by telling you how honored Dave, Mike, Rich, and I are to be here before you in the national tournament. We are honored that you came to see us. Let me begin with the plan objections. First, the gentlemen tell us that we don't indict all covert operations. Indeed, there is no reason to assume that we don't make that distinction or that there's any distinction to make. Note, please, the second and third contention talks only about covert operations. The gentleman never tells us where the Defense Department has done anything successfully in the past, and the reason is that the CIA is doing it now. They would be doing it under the affirmative plan if we didn't eliminate all covert operations. That's the rationale. Second, the gentleman says, look, you're only indicting a policy. Correct. But when we strangle the avenue to that policy, we reduce executive control. Therein lies the way that we are on the topic. Third, the gentleman says, look, with respect to your harms, you don't prove that your harms are inherent to covert operations. That's true. We can strengthen communism in many ways. We can also injure innocent people. Some people take rat poisoning by mistake. That in no way indicates that we don't solve a very important harm. We don't think we should be contributing to this problem. Each harm is unique in itself. Then the gentleman says, we'll still be blamed. Rich asks, with what harm? All we're given is the assertion that in the Middle East, and I don't care who said it, that in the Middle East, the threat of a CIA coup caused the Six-Day War between Israel and Egypt. I don't believe it. The judgment is up to you. But finally, we suggested that allegations don't hurt us with respect to the NSA, and the gentleman is not responsive. With respect to the harm to our nationalists, etc., the Chinese are still in Red China. We say we don't solve the problems that we discuss. We're trying to prevent future harms. We can't go back and correct the errors of the past. Second, the gentleman says with respect to innocence, we can still bribe them. We said, number one, it's an assertion that that will realize the same harms that we discussed. But number two, we challenge the gentleman to make the value judgment. We say we should accept the harms of intelligence gathering. Why? Because
because intelligence gathering is vital to us. That's why we should accept the harms. The gentlemen don't respond to the challenge. With respect to Indonesia, all they tell us is that Sukarno and Indonesia used us as a scapegoat. That does in no way indicate that this threatened peace, injured innocent people, or strengthened the communists. I don't think the gentlemen are proving that the plan won't solve our harms. Now the gentleman makes three arguments. Number one, he says, look, with respect to harm in our own national interest and bribery in the U-2 flights, he has still asserted to you that the U-2 flights would threaten peace. We said there were only suspicions, and the gentleman asserts to you there could be war. They have never proved that our harms can be created even by intelligence gathering. The gentleman says you can't separate intelligence from operations because it spills over, and then has the nerve to assert to you in the last speech that that's inherent to the process. All it said, all the evidence said, was that intelligence men sometimes do covert operations. They will not because it's illegal under the affirmative plan. Then we also said that with respect to intelligence, covert operatives in the field are harmful. They slant information and the gentleman doesn't come back. Finally, he says we'll use overt operations. Why? He says because we'll have no choice. We asked the gentleman to show you that President Kennedy would have invaded Cuba, that we would have announced to the world we were overthrowing the Guatemalan regime, that we would have announced to the world that we were going to have their coup in the Middle East. I don't think we ever would have done so. Lyman Kirkpatrick writes, the United States will not intervene overtly where it intervenes covertly or with clandestine means today, and it's logical to assume why not. The gentlemen prove it for you when they say that overt intervention is more harmful. He drops his analysis on Reischauer and Hilsman. Let's return to the need area. Look at those disadvantages. They're based on assertions, and none of them are significant. Finally, the gentleman says, look, why do you accept Dulles' assertion that the CIA was involved, but not that they were valuable? Can you see Dulles getting up and saying, yes, I did all these things, but they were disastrous for the United States? He directed the CIA. He's not going to say that. The gentlemen make their assertion on the Mideast and nothing else. And finally, we get to Laos. Now, we say that one-third of the country is in trouble now. The gentleman says that they're involved with their own problems at the present time. The problems are with the path at Laos. If Suvana had control of the country, he wouldn't have the problems, and he could stop the infiltration. They don't deny that we caused the harm. They've never denied that. Second, with respect to Burma, all they say is it wasn't a long-run harm. We said it was disastrous in the short run, and they're not responsive. And finally, with respect to the Bay of Pigs, all the gentleman says is if we had used more force, it could have been effective. He asserts that. Roger Hilsman writes, the second strike, when the planes had already been dispersed, had no hope of achieving its objective. We couldn't have been successful. We were in trouble already. The harms certainly are manifest in the area of communism. Number two, we injure the innocent. All the gentleman talked about is British Guiana, dropping the NSA in Berlin, which they've admitted the significance of all through the debate, and all he says that there were riots. The riots were against the United States. That's how people were killed. They were anti-U.S. riots. People were killed, and we suggest the harm. With respect to strengthening communism, all the gentleman says is, how could China bomb us? They didn't have nuclear weapons. They've got a lot of junk. But we would suggest there could have been a conventional war. We said we were on the brink of nuclear war, or on the brink of a total war, at least. The United States contemplated the use of nuclear weapons. The gentleman isn't responsive to that analysis. Look at those harms. They're totally untouched. With respect to the second contention, all they want to know is how can publicity best expose them? We read you conclusionary evidence to counter their conclusionary evidence that publicity is the best way to stop a communist. No response. Finally, they reassert their point on Indonesia. I challenge them to show you that the coup would not have taken place anyway. They don't do that, so the CIA wasn't necessary. And finally, with respect to Jagan, we said there was no threat. We said we didn't do anything, and we said we were harmed when we tried to. The gentlemen have two examples that try to counter our value judgment. They drop the examples and don't prove them. Without that, they can't prove the judgment. We suggest that we should not accept the cost of covert intervention.
From the six judges I mentioned before, and Ted Jackson of Michigan State, we have some awards for the teams that lost to these two very fine teams in the semifinal round. Or rather, we almost have some awards. We have three of the awards we want to give. The fourth one was the wrong size, and we asked for a replacement, and it has not arrived yet. So I hope that it will be acceptable to all the teams if we present two of these trophies to the two runners-up in the semifinals, and we will send a duplicate trophy as a permanent memento to the first-place team. They will take something rather large home with them in any case. But our two semifinalists are University of California at Los Angeles and Loyola. So would they come forward, please?